Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. One of the ways humans deal with death is to create memorials for those we've lost.
A lot of beautiful angels here too.
A lot of angels. They're mostly female angels, which is interesting.
I'm walking around Laurel Hill Cemetery in Philadelphia with Nick McAllister. He's the executive director here. This place was founded in 1836 and it's huge. I can see hundreds and hundreds of monuments, tall obelisks pointing toward the sky, beautiful ornate works of art.
Yeah. But wow, look at this. The detail is just amazing.
On one headstone, there is a portrait of the departed, intricately etched into the stone.
Even the stitches around the buttonhole.
Yeah, I'm touching his lapel, his bow tie.
But we're here to see another grave with a beautiful monument for spiritualist Catherine Drinkhouse Smith.
And she passed to the spirit life 15 minutes before 12 o'clock.
It's about 10 feet tall. It has five sides. It looks like solid stone, but it's made from metal.
It's actually hollow, and you can hear it resonate.
Catherine Drinkhouse Smith spent her days trying to connect the dead with the living, and she made sure her tombstone would tell the world about it.
Mrs. Smith was a devoted spiritualist and one of the best mediums of her time, and accomplished great good in spreading this beautiful truth and in demonstrating a continuity of life.
Spiritualism was very popular during the Victorian era. It was a religious belief that the dead moved on to another realm where they were still accessible to us.
It wasn't a matter of heaven and hell. I think it was a kind of a neutral space where spirits went when they left the body.
And people like Mrs. Smith, who called themselves mediums, they said they could communicate with these spirits.
Through flickering of lights, rapping on tables.
In those days, many common diseases were still fatal. Childhood mortality was high. The Civil War claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. Death was a frequent visitor. And talking to spirits was a way grieving people felt like they could check in with their loved ones.
Wanting to know where they are, if everything's okay, what happened, things that were left unresolved, if everything's okay, if they're at peace.
It's hard to accept death as final. We humans have always struggled with that. Many people believe that our spirits or souls live on, that we're never fully gone. And modern medicine has truly blurred the line between life and death and what it means to be gone. You can be breathing, your heart beating thanks to machines, but your brain is no longer working. So are you still alive? On today's episode, we'll explore the strange space between being alive and being dead, when you're neither here nor there. Let's start with how modern medicine has changed how we think about death. It's gotten so complicated, it sometimes now becomes a legal issue. For example, a high court in Ontario, Canada, had to decide whether a 27-year-old woman who was declared dead by her doctors was, in fact, dead. Alan Yu has more.
It was September 2017. Takesha McKitty lay unconscious on a sidewalk in a suburb of Toronto. She had had a drug overdose. She had no pulse. An ambulance rushed her to the hospital. When her father, Stanley Stewart, got the call, he jumped into the car to go to the hospital. Around 15 family members, cousins, Takesha's mother, all gathered in the waiting room. One of the emergency room doctors said that she was in intensive care.
Everybody was just in shock and scared, and no one didn't really know what to think or say or expect. So everybody was kind of quiet.
Then they visited her, 2 to 3 people at a time. Stanley and the family made sure someone was with her 24 hours a day, so she would not be alone when she woke up.
People would set for a couple hours, and someone else would go in for a couple hours, and we just did that for days and days.
Takesha's eyes were closed. If you called her name, her head would move a little. More importantly, to understanding what state she was in, at first she was breathing on her own. But then, 6 days after she was first admitted, that stopped. The medical team immediately put her on a ventilator and checked her brain. They found that her brain was so irreversibly damaged that it could no longer control her breathing. Without that ventilator, her heart would stop. They said Takesha was brain dead. The doctors told Stanley they had done all the tests, and there's nothing else they could do for her. It was time to turn off the ventilator. Stanley, Takesha's father, said no.
From our point of view, our belief that she wasn't dead until her heart had stopped, until her soul left her body.
They are Christian.
Whose life is it? Is it the hospital's life? Or is it, you know, her life, her family's life, her daughter's life? Who has the say? We believe that it's God's final say.
Stanley says what the doctors wanted to do goes against his family's religious beliefs.
They're in charge of my daughter's life, and they're going to terminate it based on their own medical concept of life and death. I didn't agree with it. I called a lawyer, and we put a legal injunction in to stop them from being able to pull the plug.
Stanley and the family asked the hospital to do the tests again, and they did. Doctors repeated the tests 3 different times over the next few weeks. Same result, Takesha was brain dead. After that, Stanley and the doctors stopped talking to each other as much because it was now a legal battle. Meanwhile, Takesha lay on an inclined bed with a ventilator, a feeding tube, a heart monitor, and bags of fluids connected to her. And then?
She started moving around. She started doing things that she wasn't supposed to be doing, or dead people aren't supposed to be doing. So once we started seeing some of those movements, that kind of raised a red flag for us again. And it's like, something's not right about this.
A lot of family members came to visit. They would pray for Takesha, tell her they loved her. And Stanley says it's like she hurt them.
She would have a tear run down her eye, and she, you know, continued. She did that for months. She would have tears roll up in her eyes when you would talk to her, or certain people, you'd come in and say, hey, this is so-and-so, and I miss you, I love you. You could see a tear would ball up in her eye.
Her fingers would twitch, tickle her feet, and they would pull back. Stanley saw all this and thought, this is not a dead person. He stopped working for 7 or 8 months. He'd sleep, go home, eat something, then come back.
Spent a lot of money paying for internet and parking, you know, $100 a month parking. I think it was like $25 a week on internet, just to keep yourself entertained for the hours that you were there, reading books, magazines, eat dinner, eat lunch, Tim Hortons, coffee.
Meanwhile, the court battle continued. 9 months after Takesha came to the hospital, a high court in Canada ruled that she was dead, and the hospital could stop the ventilator. Stanley and his lawyer appealed that decision. A few months later, in December 2018, Takesha's heart stopped on its own, and Stanley and her family agreed she had died. She was buried in January. But that court battle is still going on. Stanley has not given up on it, because he wants to change the law. He wants other families to be able to say, we don't think someone is dead just because their brain stops working. He says you should be allowed to challenge brain death on religious grounds.
That's what we were fighting for. We weren't just these crazy people who couldn't let go of their daughter because we were so distraught. It was nothing like that. We made educated, informed decisions that we felt were in our best interest and in the best interest of my daughter.
So what's the difference? How is brain death different from death?
There has been this view, and I think it persists in being the view, that brain death really is the same thing as biological death, and that there's no reason for families to object to it because it's just a biological fact of life. It'd be like objecting to gravity.
That's pediatric intensive care doctor Robert Trug. He's also a bioethicist at Harvard Medical School. He says families have a point. Brain death is not exactly the same as biological death.
Up until really just recent history, death was a very intuitive concept. You didn't even really even need a definition.
But modern medicine has blurred those lines. In the 1950s, more doctors used ventilators. Even if someone had a massive brain injury, put them on a ventilator and they could keep breathing.
They seem to be biologically alive, but they're never going to wake up again. Is this a new and different way of being dead? Or does it count as dead, but it's not really biologically dead?
So doctors came up with the idea of brain death, which means the brain has been irreversibly injured. The person is comatose and cannot breathe on their own. The brain can't show the usual reflexes, like blinking when you touch their eyeballs, or gagging if you put something in their throat. Remember Takesha's dad saw her tear up and move her fingers and toes? Doctors say those reflexes can go through the spinal cord without involving the brain. Robert says there's actually a lot that brain dead people can still do as long as a ventilator helps them breathe.
They really do all of the things that a human body does. They can absorb nutrition, they can excrete waste, they can fight infections, even to the point where brain dead women can give birth to a living baby.
So the person is breathing thanks to a ventilator, can still show reflexes that don't involve the brain, but they are not going to wake up and become conscious again. Usually, families and doctors decide together what to do next, when to turn off the machines, and reach an agreement. In some rare cases, they disagree and end up in court. In every state in the US, a person is considered dead if their brain has lost all function irreversibly. But New Jersey lets families claim a religious exemption to treating brain death as death.
It doesn't really make sense for that to be feasible in our country, for there to be that type of variability in laws such that there could be a situation where someone is declared dead somewhere, but they're alive somewhere else.
Arianne Lewis is a neurologist at NYU Langone Medical Center in New York. She and most doctors think brain death is the same thing as death. Robert is a bit of an outlier. She says, look, it's hard when a person is declared brain dead, but a family doesn't see it as death. It's hard for families and doctors. But that being said, we have to look at the economics and practicality.
Providing ongoing treatment for somebody who's already been declared dead is a little bit impractical, given the fact that that means that that person is occupying a bed that another patient cannot be in. Additionally, is requiring services from a physician and nursing team that is not being provided to somebody else at that point in time, when there could potentially could be somebody else who has the potential to benefit from those services.
She says there should be a nationwide standard for these rare cases, where families want to keep someone on a ventilator after a medical team declares them brain dead. We should be able to decide as a country how to handle these requests. That way, the line between life and death won't be blurred, depending on whether or not you're in New Jersey.
That was Alan Yu reporting, and we first ran this story in March. Recently, a higher court in Canada has ruled against Stanley, upholding the lower court decision that religious freedom doesn't apply to patients who have already been declared brain dead. End-of-life medical care can be really difficult for families. It's a struggle to make decisions for somebody else. What if a person you love is disappearing before your eyes? Their personality and memory shrinking. They're becoming less and less like themselves every day. Would they want to live like this? Tanya Ott is facing that situation and reports this story.
My dad was in his mid-60s when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. What were once quirks became obsessions. Like, he'd hide my mom's purse in the closet because he was worried someone was going to see it through the living room window and break in to steal it. Eventually, he couldn't figure out how to use a telephone. It was a pretty quick decline, and I was losing the smart, funny guy that I loved. So 2 years ago, I took my recorder down to Florida, hoping to talk to him about his life. before the man I knew slipped away for good. I prompted him with questions about growing up on a farm in Iowa, about joining the Air Force during Vietnam. It did not go well.
I don't know.
Okay. It's all good.
No, it's not all. I know some things happen, and I know.
I was trying to connect with him, but it was hard. And a few months later, we moved Dad to a memory care unit. He's still there today. He doesn't even know that my mom died last year. We didn't tell him because we didn't want him to grieve over and over. But her death has each of us in the family thinking about our end and how we'd want to navigate it. Mom had emphysema, and during her last hospitalization, she needed a ventilator. The doctor said that she'd likely never get off the breathing machine. So my mom, who was very lucid at the time, chose to withdraw treatment. My brother, sisters, and I were all with her when she took her last breath. Recently, I gathered my sisters on Skype to talk about all that we've been through in the last year.
I appreciate the fact that mom chose and had that ability to choose.
That's my sister Danielle Springsteen.
I don't think that Dad would have wanted things to be like they are now.
I think with Dad's situation, it's entirely different.
That's my youngest sister, Krista Ott. She's Dad's healthcare surrogate. She makes all the decisions about his treatment, what to do and what not to do.
He's not competent to make those decisions because sometimes he doesn't even know his own name.
In six states and Washington, D.C., a doctor can prescribe drugs that will help a person end their life. We call it physician-assisted suicide or death with dignity. But lots of people have problems with those terms, so experts have started using the phrase medical aid in dying. It's not an option for people with Alzheimer's. And to understand why, you have to understand how medical aid in dying works. First, you have to verbally tell a doctor that you want it. That starts the clock ticking. Within 15 days, you have to find two doctors who agree that you're terminally ill, will likely die within 6 months, and are competent. Then you have to write a written request for life-ending medication that has to be witnessed by two people. The doctor holds on to the prescription for 48 hours before snail mailing or hand-delivering it to a pharmacy.
When we hand someone life-ending medication, the last official thing we say is, "Now, you do understand, Tanya, that when you drink this, you will fall asleep, you will slip into a coma, and you will die."
That's Sally McLaughlin. She leads End of Life Washington in Seattle.
And the problem is, a person with dementia, you can't be sure they understand that.
Even if a person clearly expressed their wishes back when they were competent, it's complicated. Gregory Pence is a bioethicist at the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
Let's suppose I go a year into my diagnosis, and I'm in a locked unit somewhere, and my family and the staff see someone who likes the Bee Gees, who likes Breyers ice cream, and the person I used to be hated the Bee Gees, didn't really like ice cream. But this looks like a pretty happy person. How could we possibly kill him?
Medical aid in dying is not available to people with Alzheimer's, but ethicist Wendy Walters says some people with dementia find a way to end their life on their terms. Wendy trained as a clinical social worker and spent decades working in hospice. Now she's the clinical ethics consultant for the hospital at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Recently, she reviewed the case of a man diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. He had helped care for his mother-in-law, who also had the disease, and it wasn't the life that he wanted. So he shot himself and was left with massive injuries.
He didn't kill himself. And it became a very large ethical dilemma for the trauma team because family says he would never want to live like this. They want to withdraw life support.
Wendy had to weigh in.
It was going to be multiple surgeries, and he would never be able to eat naturally again. He would have to be able to be tube fed for the rest of his life.
Ultimately, Wendy allowed the medical team to stop life support. In another case, an older woman with Alzheimer's was reliving the Holocaust, and every moment was terrifying to her. So maybe no physical pain, but certainly extreme emotional pain. Some ethicists and medical professionals are starting to ask whether the healthcare system should offer more options for people with the disease. My sister Krista says she doesn't know if Dad would have chosen medical aid in dying,
but she's sure he would have at least wanted the option.
When we have pets and we treat them like our family and we love them and they live in the home with us, when that pet gets to the point where we know that they're suffering, we are deemed cruel if we do not humanely euthanize them. And so often we don't treat our senior citizens or our aging population with that same respect. We hold on to them. We put them through more medical procedures. We put them in uncomfortable lifestyles that they would not choose for themselves. So in a lot of ways, it seems like we give animals a lot more respect, comfort, and care than we do the people in our lives.
That's Krista Ott. She's been involved in the care of her father, who has Alzheimer's. The story was reported by her sister, Tanya Ott. Coming up, at first, a California mom thought of a vial stored in a freezer as just that, a vial in a freezer. But now?
Now I think of it like this is a full sibling to my daughter. And wouldn't it be amazing if I had another child, because she could have a sibling?
What to do with frozen embryos? That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Today's episode is about the space between life and death, when we're not fully here, but also not really gone. Many women conceive children through in vitro fertilization. In the simplest terms, eggs are surgically retrieved from the woman, then those eggs are fertilized in a petri dish, and finally implanted into the uterus. The process is difficult, long, and expensive, and clinics usually try to create a surplus of embryos to up the chances at success. And that means that thousands and thousands of such embryos end up frozen in time. Liz Tung has more.
Jessica Ivry's been on the fence for a while now. It's a decision she tries not to think about, but every month she gets a reminder in the form of a bill.
$45 a month, and I just got a letter that it's going up to $50 a month.
For Jessica, every dollar counts. She's a single mom living in the Bay Area, which is super expensive. And to top it all off,
I'm a musician and a public music school teacher.
So Jessica's not exactly rolling in dough. And yet every month she pays a $45, soon to be $50 storage fee for a single frozen embryo, which for the past 4 years has resided at the clinic where Jessica went to get fertility treatments.
I think I'm still holding on to it because I just can't make a decision. I think that's what it is. I think it's more about my inability at this point to make a decision.
It's a significant issue. There are easily hundreds of thousands of embryos, if not more, around the United States that are frozen and waiting for some form of disposition.
That's Eric Widra. He's the medical director for a chain of fertility clinics called Shady Grove. And what he just said a second ago was disposition, as in embryo disposition, which is the official term for what people decide to do with their frozen embryos once they finish with IVF. It's a possibility patients are confronted with before they even start the process, in the form of a consent document that lays out four options for what to do with frozen embryos. One, keep them frozen in case you want more kids down the line. Two, donate them to scientific research. Three, donate them to another person or a couple trying to conceive. Or four, dispose of the embryo, which essentially involves taking it out of the freezer and letting it thaw. So those are the options. Pretty much something for everyone. Keep, dispose, or donate. But Eric says a lot of patients agonize over what to do with their remaining embryos.
They're torn because they feel a certain responsibility to these embryos. They've created them. They often went through sometimes years of pain and infertility in order to get to the point where they have children. But there's a spectrum of comfort, among patients with discarding them or donating them. But I think everyone struggles a bit with how to think about these embryos.
Embryos are like the Rorschach test of the fertility world. Patients, doctors, even state laws see them as wildly different creatures with wildly different meanings. They can be tiny little lives or just bits of medical tissue. They could be considered property or, if pro-life activists have their way, an actual person. And all of that's just the baseline for how we as a culture think about embryos. It's ambiguous and messy. And it's even messier for the women and couples who have to decide what to do with them. One researcher who knows that better than most is Anne Lyerly. She's an OBGYN and bioethicist. She also teaches at the University of North Carolina's Medical School. And around 2005-2006, she started interviewing fertility patients about what they were deciding to do with their frozen embryos, which at this point, surprisingly few researchers had done.
And those were really spectacular, eye-opening interviews, I have to say.
Anne says some people thought of the embryos as actual living beings. Other people thought of them as just raw biological material, but most people fell somewhere in between. But no matter where they landed, there's a feeling almost all of them shared.
Individuals felt like there was a significance to the embryo. And also for many of these individuals, there was a pretty large emotional and financial investment in them. So whatever they understood to be their responsibility and whatever they understood to be the moral status of the embryo, it had a value to them in their lives.
Which is why a lot of people felt like their options for disposition just weren't good enough, weren't respectful enough. So they came up with some of their own ideas for what a good disposal process would look like.
So one possibility women came up with was to have some kind of ceremony where they could have a quiet moment with their embryo, where they could say goodbye. The other thing that they came up with, and it was so interesting because we heard this more than once, was the idea of having the embryo put back in their body at a time that they would not be likely to get pregnant.
Anne says a lot of the women she talked to worried that people would find these ideas kind of weird, but she says they're representative of the enormous investment, financial, emotional, physical, that women go through with IVF. For Jessica Ivry, that process started in 2014. She had just hit 40, was single, and knew that she wanted kids. So she decided to try out IVF, which, for those who don't know, can be a really grueling process. And a lot of the time, it doesn't even work. Jessica remembers how she felt after her first failed round of IVF.
It's completely heartbreaking. It's all-consuming. There's no way to just, like, carry on, everything's fine. I mean, it's painful. Even thinking about it, it's painful.
Stories like Jessica's are really common. For women 40 and older, the chance of getting pregnant with just one round of IVF is only 8%, which means a lot of them end up going through multiple rounds, some as many as 8 or 9. And remember, each round is an involved, invasive, and expensive marathon, with an average cost of $12,000 per round. Anne Lyerly says the hope and desperation some women feel at the outset can make it really hard to contemplate the idea of having extra embryos when they're starting out.
What I would say is, like, when you're in the state of mind where you're thinking about wanting a baby and that every embryo is precious to you because it's possibly going to be that baby that you want, very few felt prepared to make that decision when they arrived at needing to make it.
This was Jessica's situation exactly. After months of being pumped full of hormones and medications, after spending thousands of dollars and countless hours in doctor's offices, her chances boiled down to 2 healthy embryos, one of which would be implanted and the other stored away. That first one,
Mommy,
it became her daughter.
I got chocolate, vanilla.
Her name's Esther. Jessica calls her Esty.
And what are you going to do with all of those things?
They're ice cream flavors.
The other embryo, the sole survivor of Jessica's 2 rounds of IVF, stayed in storage. But a funny thing happened after Jessica's daughter was born. she stopped thinking of the frozen embryo as just an embryo and started thinking of it as something more real.
It was so abstract then. Now I think of it like this is a full sibling to my daughter. And wouldn't it be amazing if I had another child because she could have a sibling?
It's something Jessica's been thinking about ever since her daughter was born, completing their little family with that one last embryo. But she says now that she's in her mid-40s, it's looking less and less likely that that embryo would be able to turn into a real live baby. It's just not practical, financially or physically.
So I sort of, like, secretly in the back of my head think maybe miraculously in the next 3 years, some circumstances will change, you know, and I will be able to do it. But at this point, I don't know how it could happen. It's really sad to me to think of having the fertility clinic discard the embryo. I would much rather donate it and have someone use it.
Jessica's actually tried to find couples to adopt her embryo, but so far nothing's worked out. She says even after years of talking and thinking about it, of looking for solutions, she still has no idea what to do. So for now, she and her embryo will just continue to wait, both of them frozen in a kind of endless limbo.
That was Liz Tong reporting. Today's episode is about the space between life and death, when we're neither here nor there. When somebody almost dies, like after a heart attack, a near-fatal accident or injury, there is a brief moment when they are slipping away. But if they live to tell about it, that moment of coming face-to-face with death becomes a source of endless fascination.
My name is Linda Tate. I am currently 54 years old, going to be 55 soon. I live in a small town, rural town in Oregon. In my early 40s, I had a near-death experience that was quite life-changing.
Andrew Stelzer brings us Linda's story.
It was a late afternoon, and Linda was folding laundry.
And I all of a sudden just felt very weak, very dizzy. I had a really sharp pain in my abdomen, and I just instantly knew I was in trouble. And I just made it just out the door, and down I went. I collapsed on the porch, and everything started feeling very fuzzy, very far away. And I heard my daughter come out on the porch and yell, "Oh my gosh, Mom, are you okay?" And I heard my dad yell, "I'll call 911. And in my mind, I distinctly remember thinking, well, this is how it's probably going to end. It's out of my hands now, so I'm just going to relax and, you know, wait and see what happens.
Linda says a peaceful feeling came over her. And then
I saw a hand reach down. And instinctively, I think just in my mind, I don't think I moved my body. I took the hand and I stood up and felt like a pop, like a disconnect from my physical body. And I looked up and my deceased auntie Lil was standing there smiling at me. And she said, "Come with me." And we stepped out into the grassy area in front of my house. And I have to tell you, it was like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. You know how it starts out black and white and then it turns into color when she gets to Oz? That was the difference between the world I was living in and the one I stepped into. It was flowers and butterflies and birds and just this cacophony of beautiful sounds mixed with gorgeous colors. My aunt and I stood there and I watched things happening, and I looked at her and I said, "What's happening to me?" And she said, "You're having a period of transition." And I went, "Okay." And so we just stood there in silence and I watched the ambulance pull up, and I heard my daughter screaming, "I'm not ready to lose my mom. Please save my mom. Oh my God, please help me." I saw my cat. It was pouring down rain that day, and my cat was running outside and covering my body and then running back inside, like frantically back and forth. And then all of a sudden, my auntie turned to me and she kissed my cheek and she said, "You're going to have to go back. I'm sorry."
Linda didn't really want to go back.
And then the next thing I know, I woke up in the ambulance, and I had slipped into hypothermia because it was so cold out, and they were yelling my name and warming me up and trying to get me going again.
Linda ended up okay. She had serious internal bleeding when she initially collapsed. So how typical is her story? I ran it by Jeffrey Long. He's a radiation oncologist and a researcher of near-death experiences.
That out-of-body experience is what we call it when their consciousness separates and goes above the body. It's not unusual for them to meet deceased loved ones.
Jeffrey founded the Near Death Experience Research Foundation in Houma, Louisiana, over 20 years ago. He's collected around 4,000 near-death experience stories.
Whenever they encounter a being they knew during their earthly life, almost invariably, about 95% of the time, the being is deceased. And it's not at all unusual that near-death experiencers are told, you have to go back, you have to return. That's a very common thing, very classic near-death experience.
Jeffrey defines near-death experiences as cases when people are unconscious, have stopped breathing, and have no heart rate for a period of time. And while he emphasizes that no two are the same, there are some common themes. Sometimes there's the stereotypical light at the end of the tunnel, or a life review, the so-called life flashing before one's eyes.
And then, from time to time, at the end of the experience, they're involved in a decision about whether to return to their earthly life or stay in that unearthly realm. Around this time, they're typically experiencing overwhelmingly intensely positive emotions. The two most common words used to describe a near-death experience is peace and love.
Of course, these are all just descriptions coming from people after they've returned to the living. But medically, physiologically, what's happening to the body during this time? Jeffrey wrote a book called Evidence of the Afterlife: The Science of Near-Death Experiences.
Near-death experiences are absolutely medically inexplicable.
Jeffrey says that about 10 to 20 seconds after blood stops flowing, brain electrical activity goes absolutely flat. So there's no way to explain how they would have conscious thoughts or in many cases can later describe what was happening around them. But science writer Michael Shermer disagrees. He's the publisher of Skeptic magazine.
The near-death experience is a experience of neural activity. The person is not going anywhere. They're just there in their head in exactly the same way as people who have hallucinations.
Michael says the out-of-body experience can be recreated by doctors poking at patients' brains during surgery.
So there is this one spot in the temporal lobes where if you touch it, the person will feel like, I am floating out of my body right now. I am 3 feet above my body looking down, or I'm way up by the ceiling.
He says it's important to remember that by definition, if the person survives, they weren't actually dead. His metaphor, the lights don't just get turned off with a switch. It's more like they are gradually being dimmed.
And so there's a transitional period there, 30 seconds, a minute, maybe 2 minutes, 3 minutes, depending on, say, it's a drowning or a heart attack, where there's a window of opportunity for these anomalistic psychological experiences to happen.
Michael acknowledges that not all neuroscientists agree with him. Some believe there are aspects to near-death experiences we simply don't yet understand. But either way, Michael says we shouldn't focus too much on the afterlife.
Nobody knows for sure, so it's okay to keep an open mind. But don't construct a whole world about that happens after this in your imagination and miss out on this world. It's this world we know for sure exists, and that's what counts.
For Linda Tate, her takeaway is that we shouldn't fear the end. In fact, it might be kind of nice.
I definitely look forward to going back to whatever form that was that I was in. It just felt light and carefree and just nothing to worry about, like everything just was.
That story was reported by Andrew Stelzer. Hearing about these near-death experiences, you can't help but wonder if all of this is shaped by religion, rituals, ceremonies, what we believe will happen after we die. There are lots of common themes across different faith traditions and cultures. Avishai Artsy looks at how people throughout time have thought about what comes after our earthly existence.
In Mexico, the Day of the Dead is a celebration to revere and remember the ancestors. In Los Angeles, where I live, lots of us join in. We paint our faces with skulls and build ritual altars or ofrendas. On top, we place the food and drink our loved ones enjoyed while they were alive. Why do we do this? Ophelia Esparza says it's because of this belief that we all suffer three deaths.
The first death is the day that we give our last breath, the day that we die. And that our second death is the day that we're buried, never to be seen on the face of the earth again. That's pretty permanent. And the third, but the most dreaded death of all, is to be forgotten. That's a final death.
Ophelia is a master ofrenda builder in East LA, and you may have heard this traditional Mexican story if you've seen the Pixar movie Coco. Ophelia was a consultant on the film about a young boy who travels to the land of the dead, and there he sees a skeleton fade to dust and blow away.
Wait, what happened?
He's been forgotten. When there's no one left in the living world who remembers you, you disappear from this world. We call it the final death.
This overarching theme that our spirits linger on is found in many religions and cultures. If you're Catholic, when you die, your soul might go to purgatory, or a limbo state called Barzakh if you're Muslim. If you believe in reincarnation, then after each life on Earth, your soul goes to an in-between place. Tibetan Buddhists call it the Bardo state. There are lots of colorful explanations in ancient cultures for what happens after you die. Egyptians believe that Osiris, the god of the dead, weighs your heart against an ostrich feather. If your heart is impure, you're fed to a beast called the Devourer of the Dead. And once that part lion, hippopotamus, and crocodile creature is done with you, your soul is destroyed forever. The ancient Greeks saw the afterlife as gloomy. In Homer's account, when the hero Odysseus visits the underworld, the dead are excited to greet the new visitor.
It's a fairly kind of bland and neutral afterlife. Everyone is sort of down there, standing around. It's a bit boring.
That's David Saunders, a curator of antiquities at the Getty Museum in LA. He says the Greeks believed that the winged messenger Hermes delivers the dead to a ferryman who transports your soul across the river Styx. Going on some kind of journey after you die is also a theme in accounts from the Etruscans. They lived in central Italy before the Romans and left behind tomb paintings with vivid murals. Claire Lyons, also a curator of antiquities at the Getty, describes one of the murals.
You see very frightening looking demons with blue and black skin, terrifying looking, who are escorting a deceased person past a rather arduous rocky landscape.
Claire says the demons weren't torturing the souls, just kind of pushing them along. The murals in the Tomb of the Blue Demon also show a ship waiting in the distance, ready to transport the dead through an arch door with heavy bolts.
And those who have conducted the proper rituals, who have sacrificed appropriately to the gods, will be admitted.
Into a happier place filled with feasting, drinking wine, song, and dance.
It's a very beautiful and more hopeful vision.
More hopeful than the nightmarish journey that brought you to this afterlife.
That was Avishai Artsy reporting. On today's episode, we've been talking about the space between life and death and existing somewhere in between. Medicine and science have blurred the line between being alive and dead, not just in humans. Daisy Ginsberg is a London artist who's been working with scientists to bring back the scent of flowers that have long been extinct.
For me, it was dizzying. As an artist, and I got incredibly excited about what to me was a feat of the technological sublime, this sort of feeling of looking down sort of into the past through the lens of technology to smell something that we would never otherwise smell.
Daisy partnered with synthetic biologists from a Boston biotech company called Ginkgo Bioworks, and they extracted DNA samples from pressed flowers at the Harvard Herbarium.
Our three flowers that we've ended up with. And it's incredibly difficult to get the DNA from those samples. They range from 100 to 200 years old, and they, you know, have degraded. And working eventually with a team of paleogeneticists at the University of California, Santa Cruz, they were able to get DNA fragments out of these samples.
From those fragments, scientists looked for similar organisms that had matching bits of DNA and particular genes that produce enzymes that make smell molecules to fill in the gaps of the sequence for those three different flowers.
So in the end, you get a list, a kind of a shopping list of ingredients. But of course, we don't know the exact amounts of each of those smell molecules. So you end up with a sketch of how it might have smelled. It's like baking a cake with just, you know, randomly using different amounts of butter and flour, depending what cake you're making.
Give me an example of the flowers. So how long ago did these flowers go extinct? What do we know about them? Do we know what they looked like?
The most recent extinction is the Hibiscodelphus wilderianus, which is a hibiscus that grew on the southern slopes of Mount Haleakala in Hawaii on the island of Maui. And that flower went extinct around 1912. The hibiscus is this green flower which has a long red centerpiece, and it grows on a tree. And I never even think of hibiscus, you know, on a tree. Then we go step back in time a bit further, and the next flower is called the Orbexilum stipulatum, or the Falls of the Ohio Scurf Pea. And it was only found on one island in the Ohio River near Louisville, Kentucky. And it was last seen in 1881.
This delicate pea plant had purple flowers. The third flower to have its smell resurrected from extinction was called Lucidendrum grandiflorum. It's native to Cape Town, but was last seen in a collector's garden in London in 1806. Daisy is now working all of these smells into an immersive art installation.
I think it's much more evocative and sort of tingles down your spine thinking, well, this is something that no one has smelled, or a version of it that no one has smelled for over a century.
To get the full experience of the smells, she's created large metal hoods about 3 feet by 3 feet that hang from the ceiling.
And you duck underneath it, put your head inside, and the smell of the flower diffuses around your head. There's the incredible feeling of actually smelling something. And I went this morning to smell the Orbexilum stipulatum at the fabricator where we're building one of these installations. And it's the first time I've smelled this flower. And I had this amazing moment in a warehouse in East London, standing in the middle of the freezing cold with a forklift truck holding the hood over my head, smelling this beautiful, sweet perfume of a lost pea flower. But at the same time, you get a sense of the ambivalence of biology. You know, does it really matter that this is gone? The human is the absolute connecting element for me in the installations we're building. You know, the flower doesn't care that it's gone. We care that it's gone. And there's a feeling of loss that I'm very interested in.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Daisy Ginsberg's work is called Resurrecting the Sublime. She did this in collaboration with artist and smell researcher Cecil Tolas and synthetic biologist Christina Agapakis. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jet Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Everyone, when will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.